Welcome to the Multifamily Deal Lab Podcast, where we dissect a deal before your eyes and ears so you can discover the strategies and tactics that got each deal to the finish line. Strategies and tactics that you can put in your own toolbox to get you to the closing table. From sourcing the deal, raising, due diligence to the property takeover, Multifamily Deal Lab shows how you too can get the deal done. And now here's your host, David Lindahl.
Everybody, welcome to Multifamily Deal Lab. I'm your host, Dave Lindahl.
I'm going to start today with a quote from one of my favorites, Teddy Roosevelt. It's called "The Man in the Arena." It's not the critic who counts, not the one who points out how the strong man stumbled or how the doer of deeds might have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred with sweat and dust and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs and comes up short again and again, who knows the great enthusiasms and great devotions and spends himself in a worthy cause, who, if he wins, knows the triumph of high achievement, and who, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who know neither victory nor defeat. All right, well, I want to welcome my special guest, Corey Peterson. Corey, tell everybody who you are, where you're from.
Yeah, and here in Phoenix, Arizona, and gosh, I've been doing multifamily since 2011. I think I got into your training program in 2009, and let's just say I don't think we own over $95 million of commercial apartment real estate, and life is good.
Life is good. That's great. Yeah, so we've known each other for quite a while now. Your business continues to grow and grow. That's awesome. You know what I want to do, though, is I want to bring everybody back to your first deal. And let's talk about, first of all, the fear, how you overcame the fear of doing your first deal. What was that first deal, by the way?
I bought it for $3.2 million in Greenville, South Carolina.
How many units?
144.
And you're from Phoenix?
Yep.
How'd you choose Greenville?
Man, it chose me, I guess. So I actually was at one of your events. And normally, you know, you go to the events and you're always trying to find people that were doing deals and that or had money. And I was like, I actually had learned how to raise private money in the single family industry. And so I was like, I'm just going to go in there to say I got a lot of money and see what happens. And so somehow
I'm sure you were very popular.
Yeah. I didn't have to pay lunch or dinner for the whole week.
That's awesome.
And a person brought me a deal and it was his deal. It wasn't mine, but they were getting ready to go hard and they didn't have the money needed. And I was able to rescue their deal and I got 75% ownership of it.
That's awesome. So I brought in
$1.4 million.
Wow. And that's from your single family days. How many investors was that?
Seven. It was seven investors.
Nice.
So I knew them well.
So you were making the jump to single family to multifamily. So talk about that transition and what fears you had.
It was scary. So like even that first deal, I mean, what happened was like the reason I got into the multifamily was because in the single family fix and flip life, my life was crazy hectic. Like I was the jack of all, you know, I was just doing chunker to the point where I was becoming a bad dad, right? Just run around crazy. And I knew that I needed to do something different. And that's when I found your book, Multifamily Millions. And I was like, that's the lifestyle that I want. I know apartments is the answer. And so when you come to that point, you're like, what do I know? I didn't know enough. And so, well, who has the information? And you did. You've been teaching forever. And so I think what helped me get through the fear initially was understanding the training and like that's like just follow the steps. It's not rocket science, but just like if you say to do this, then do this. And that's all I did was just like, okay, how do I underwrite the deal? I think then the underwriting part is where I did a lot of good due diligence, right?
Yeah.
Seeing the value add, seeing the repositioning play, understanding the market. Where I was at in South Carolina was a great market. And so it gave me a lot of confidence to go out there on my first one because it was a little bit bigger than I would have normally done, but I had a lot of, by doing all that market research and understanding the opportunity, I felt a lot better in going out and doing it, but it was still nervous.
The window of opportunity was open. You jumped through. It was a proven system. It's been proven since I think I created it back in 1996, 1998, when I first started investing. Changes. Foundational information remains the same. It's just a matter of looking for the opportunity in the marketplace and then taking the recipe from the foundational information and how to best take advantage of that opportunity.
Yeah. You know, and I look back at that, David, and I remember, you know, when you first are raising a good chunk of money and now like I had money hard that was on the line. I still had to get this money from my investors. And of course, and like, you know, it didn't all come in the beginning. We barely made it to the finish line. Like I got that last $300,000 that I needed like the day of, but I remember I was committed to the process and I was like, I'm going to make sure it happens. I don't care how many people I got to call to bring this money in. And I did a lot of work. I made a lot of phone calls.
Hey, at least that money came in the day of the closing, right? Because I know a lot of stories or in myself where sometimes it doesn't come in and you have to come out of pocket or beg for an extension.
Yeah, and that's where it was going to be. But it did come in and I was like, man, got through that. But then the real work started because like that was just half the battle.
Before you go into that, so that was your first lesson in creating a sense of urgency with your investors, right?
Yeah.
Like first come, first serve, whoever gets it in. I mean, you got to create urgency with your investors all the time or else they will wait to the very last minute to get their money in. And then, you know, somebody always drops out in that last week. And
Like five of them, right?
That's right.
You know, everybody that said yes didn't really mean yes. What I've learned is that most of them are really maybes, but probably not. And then as you start getting now I've been doing it for a long time, it gets easier raising money. But the challenge is though, so is the raise, where we used to do a couple million. Now it's like 6, 7, 8 million. So it's you're trying to find even more money. But you always have you start getting a list of people that do it well and that will come into every deal. And then you still have all the new people that you and it really is still the rule of 50%, if not more, are never going to do it, even though they say they because things come up.
Right. And that's a rule of thumb that I've taught for a long time. I learned it through the School of Hard Knocks. 50% of the people that say they're going to give you money won't. The problem is you don't know who it is until you need to do that raise. That's why you need to oversubscribe your deals by
you really, 10%. That is the lesson. And it is the underwrite it, circle it, look at it, make it bold. It really is oversubscribe. And then eventually when you get this thing dialed in right, you can kind of create a little tsunami. I mean, that's what we do now is when we pack everybody in one Zoom call.
Yeah.
And then that fear of loss, fear of missing out becomes even tighter and better. And so it gets them to like, hey, listen, we're going to fill this thing up quickly. You got to go and register and, you know, give us your soft commit now. And that's worked out really well in future deals as we've grown.
Talk about how you converted your single family investors over into multifamily investors, because I'm sure there was some fear there for them as well.
Yeah. And about a third of them never came along with me. Right. So, but it was really to the point where it's like, hey guys, they felt comfortable giving me, and I was giving them notes and deed of trust. So I was giving them collateral. And so now I'm going to go from collateral driven lending to equity lending. And here's what I found is what they really wanted was consistency. Right. And a lot of them had gotten tired of giving me their money, give it back, giving me their money and waiting for me to have that next single family flip, which sometimes they have to wait 30 or 60 days for the next one to show up. And so there was lots of gaps where they, you know, thought they were getting a better return. Truly, they weren't. And I had to show them that. I was like, guys, you think you're getting this return, but in all actuality, here's what you really make it. And so when I showed them the concept of give it to me once and then we'll stay in the deal a longer time, it made sense for them. But I had to, you know, I had to show them the value. And once they understood it, they started coming in.
Yeah. Once it actually started happening, I noticed that at the beginning of raises, people are reluctant and then they get into the deal and the mailbox money comes in every month. And then you go to resell 2 or 3 years later. And it's like, what? What do you mean you're going to sell it? You know, what are you going to put us into next?
Yeah. Where's my income? I want that paycheck. Cause they start, what I found is they really depend on those paychecks, especially your older in retirement or close to retirement people. That is what they count on is that money that they get to spend. And that's how we've pitched it. That's how we frame our deals now is that we provide an income stream. And then we have some back end, some additional profits on the back end when we sell, but they're mainly interested in the income stream that it provides along the way. And I think that's the good transition from single family to the multi is really about the consistent income.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And then a big pop at the end. It's beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. And like that's your go to vacation fund. Don't count on it, but it's there.
The last time we spoke, you talked about a unique way you're setting up your investors. You want to talk about that?
Yeah. I've learned, I think maybe you said this one time. It's like you should be challenging your capital. And man, that's something that we've done from the beginning. We used to do, where I was making 20% of the deal and give all my investors 80%. And then I started asking questions like, well, how do I make more money for Corey and still give my investors a solid return? And so we do a thing now called 6 and 6. And that's where we just give our investors a 6% pref from the beginning of the deal. And then on the sell, we give them a 6% pref annualized. So it's a total return of 12%, which is fairly cheap money. And if Corey hits it out of the park, I get a good, you know, that back end becomes really big for me.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, removing the investors from the deal and they're okay with it with a 12. I mean, first of all, you get all the equity. If you buy right, you get all the equity on the back end, number one. Number two, you can get into better deals with that type of return offering.
More deals qualify.
And those are easier deals to do.
They are. You know, not only are they easier deals, but your investors like those deals better too. Like they look at them, they have better pictures, they have a better story. And so I think it's allowed me to trade up instead of doing 1970s product to doing 1990s, 2000 product with that capital structure, right? And I think the investors like it too. And what we've learned is this, our market, and we know what pond we fish in for our investors. So we don't try to find money at RIAs or events or realist multifamily events. That's really, we call that smart money. We want smart people, but dumb money. And we find that dumb money's in the stock market.
Oh, yeah.
You know, anybody that has an IRA, anybody that's, and there's trillions of dollars, but they're, because I used to be a financial advisor, I used to tell my clients, if you get 6 to 8% total return, that's great. You're like, that's awesome. 12% may be speeding. And so if we can give them 6, that's right. And they're like, that's what their broker told them. 6 is good. And then, but we show them another 6, that's the sell. It seems to work really well because their mindset is not changed from where they're going to where they're doing. And we just say we're an alternative to the roller coaster that they've been on in the stock market.
So the key is number one, targeting your people. You're targeting people with IRAs. Then number two, I mean, look at the return they're typically getting, you know, which is much less than 6% a lot of the times on their IRAs, KEOs, 401ks.
Very much.
So you come in as a savior for that particular group. Now, if you're going at another group that's used to doing value adds and getting a 15 to 21%, you know, annual rate of return, then you're not a savior. But that's not your target market.
I would never get that money, right? Okay. So that's knowing who you are and what you do and who your avatar is. And once we've figured out and dialed in the avatar, now all our marketing is designed to answer the questions that are most important to them what they want and what they're afraid of. And so a lot of those people they get to retirement, they're afraid of, you know, do I have enough? And am I going to have enough income? So typically the investor that's in that market, stock market, is getting like a 3% return on their money. So if they had $1 million in, saved up and they're taking a 3% return, that's, you know, $30,000 a year. Well, that's not a lot of money. Most people can't live off of $30,000, but we can give them 6, that's $60,000. People will start thinking, well, I might be able to make $60,000 work. But they say, no, I can't make 30.
Yep.
So it solves a real problem for them.
Oh, it's great. I mean, it works for both sides. It's a win-win.
Yeah.
So it's awesome. Let's go back to the deal. So you had just said, anything you want to talk about going into the deal? Any other challenges you had other than the raise?
Know thy partner, right? So in the beginning, I went into partnership that I didn't quite understand our roles and responsibilities, right? Learning that, so I bought both partners out. So that was one of those things where it was a red flag. I wish I would have known that earlier, to know, not only know thy partner, but really know thy operating agreement.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's in those details of those words that are really important to understand what your voting rights are and what's the rules to that partnership. And so that was hard in the beginning, but once we paid and I bought them off, I found a number that worked for them and I just raised more capital to get them out. But then the bones of that property, like from to get to here to there, was very straightforward. So we put in, I think, $1 million of capital improvement. Like it was a nice area, but it was just a beaten up property that was bank owned. In 2011, it was in receivership. So it just had bad management and just lots of deferred maintenance. And we knew that we could fix it. And so we spent 2 years doing that. And once we did all that stuff, then we started getting a whole gentrified tenant base where now we had it modeled what our demographic was. And it started paying better and on time and collections got better. And so by that fifth year, we sold it. We sold it for $8.8 million.
And you bought it for four?
I bought it for 3.2.
Sweet. I see that happy smile. That's a lot of work to get that. You know, if you're doing a 2-year repositioning, but at the same time, it's certainly worth it in the long run.
We kept it for five though. So we repositioned it in two, and then we kept it an additional 3 years to really clean up our operations and really raise rents as high as we thought we could and keep our expenses super tight and super clean. And when we did that, and here's how we actually got all that money, is we sold it to a broken 1031 exchange. What had happened is we created a model that looks so good on paper. Like every month we were getting rent bumps, just nice. And it was just looked steady. By the fifth of the month, 98% of our income was collected because we were using ACH. We'd had a 98% portal adoption for ACH, meaning the collections get drafted automatically. That's a beautiful thing. And so it looked just very like an easy button, a bright, shiny, easy button.
Yeah.
And so
that's awesome.
We actually called the broker, and because when we came out with pricing, he's like, I don't think you can do that. I was like, listen, we're looking for a broken 1030 exchange. And when I said the words, that it made him think of somebody. And she goes, I think I got a guy that may want to be interested. And so that's what he did. He saw this big, bright, easy button and he hit it. It was like, we sold it. It's on CoStar. We sold that deal for a 4.5 cap.
That's awesome. So you took that must have been did you take it at a CC plus property and sell it as a BB minus?
Yeah.
So what type of upgrades did you do?
Flooring, LVT flooring, carpet, fixtures, knobs on the cabinet doors, refaced a lot of the cabinets, new roofs, and really just grounds. Like, gosh, it was the forest, right? It was just bad and shaggy. And we trimmed so many trees, so many bushes, taking a lot of the trees down just so it opens it up. And then interior wise, fixtures, just little things like ceiling fans.
Change the brass to brushed nickel.
Yep. Brushed nickel. Like yep.
So you're looking at this deal. It's your first one. You understand that it needs to be upgraded. The units need to be upgraded. Now, how did you determine what type of upgrade you were going to do? Did you come up with one type of an upgrade and then realize you had to upgrade it even higher, or how did that, what was that process like on your first?
That was a learning process. When we first started, we had like this basic package. And then, this is what, going through some of your training too, just thinking about, okay, how do we get the max money for this thing? And then I started throwing a challenge. I started challenging my management company. I was like, hey, listen, I know we're doing this, but what if, and we started kind of doing some test models. What if we did this one property, these two units here this way, and then challenging my staff to, and making them believe that they could achieve, $70 more in rent for this one little unit. And then they got it. And once they got it, that like, it's like shattering all your limiting beliefs for your staff
and the property.
Yeah. And once they did it, they're like, oh, well, I can do it again. And so that became the new standard. And so that's what I realized that was the secret, is getting your staff to buy in. Forget about the management company. If my people that are selling this thing don't believe it, it's never going to happen. And so that's where I spent my time, was when I would call, hey, I believe in you. I know you can do this. I know we're asking you to do a lot, but listen, you can do this. And then they would. And then it was like, attaboy, attagirl. And that got them excited about what they were doing, because they were building a nicer product too at the end of the day.
Yeah. And it would be easier for them to manage as well. Now going into that first deal, because a lot of people go into repositionings and it is a big learning process. I mean, as you know, you're a teacher now as well. You can teach and teach and teach and teach, but until somebody gets out there and starts to do it, that's when they start to realize, oh, damn, that's what he meant when he said that. Or, holy shit, I wish I knew this before I started. How long did you think it was going to take you to do that turn the entire property? And how long did it take you to do it?
Man, we thought it was going to take a year. It took 2.5, right? Yep. Just to get it done. And here's the other part. I thought I was going to make money right away. I was like, oh, I'm going to start making money. Man, I didn't make money till that third year. I wasn't really making cash flow, my cash flow, because I was sick. We didn't raise enough money for all the CapEx. Let's put it that way. I mean, that was our biggest mistake. We were taking all the money, all the profits, and putting it back in. So for 3 years, I had no paychecks coming from that asset. But I could see where we were going, and I knew it was going to come. And once after that third year, then it started paying me. I was like, wow, not only is it paying me, but I think we, you know, we've really increased the value, because you can see the difference from, I want to say we started at like $500 for a two bedroom and we ended at 7.25. That's a big jump in income.
That's for, a big bump.
Know. Yeah. And so, and that's why we sold it for the, that 8 million versus where we bought it for 3.2. But it made me, what it really did was install a belief in, for the first one, because it was hard. I mean, honestly, I'm sugarcoating it, but it was hard.
Yeah, it is hard. I mean, this isn't an easy business. Certainly, if you buy a momentum play, it's a lot easier when you get something that's cash flowing and you're buying a B property. But when you're buying something that needs a repositioning, I mean, I made my biggest mistake on my first repositioning, which was a 400 unit. And I just didn't know what I didn't know going into it. You know, so yeah. You learn all these lessons. The two main reasons that a repositioning fails is you run out of money, which you almost did because of the fact that you underestimated how much it was going to cost to turn it. And that's very common. And the second one is you hire the wrong management company to oversee the actual repositioning.
We did that.
You hired the wrong one at the beginning?
Yeah, but only for 60 days, right?
Okay.
After the first 30 days, they couldn't produce us a P&L. That was the first flag. I was like, wait, you don't have it. Like, you've been managing this whole property for a month and we have no P&L, there are no numbers. And they couldn't provide it. By the second month, they didn't provide it again. And I was with a group. This is know thy partner, know thy operating agreement. This is why we broke up, was because they had picked this management company and I was kind of going in blind thinking that they had already vetted, you know, this group out. And, but they just didn't really do a very good job. That was really tough. You know, those first 60 days are vital. You're trying to, you know, you got staffing changes. You're trying to go in and like, you know, this is how we do it. And it, we already broke the training. We broke it 60 days in.
Yeah. Were you a signer on the bank account for
yes.
the property on the operating agreement? Well, that was a smart move at least. Cause you know, a lot of times the management company will talk them out of being a signer, or they'll just forget to be a signer on the account. Management company goes bad. You go to, you'll fire them and then you can't get your money out. So you have to
yes.
start from scratch.
We've learned that a lot too. Yeah. We even now own our operating software, right? So the software that we use now, we use RealPage, but like I own RealPage and I give access to management companies to manage it, right? So,
oh, you give your version. I get it.
Yeah. So yeah. I'm always the owner of it. And that way, if I ever fire a management company, I still get to keep my software. And then I make whatever, if I hire another management company, they're like, this is the software you got to use. This is my software. But we already have all the staff. We don't have to rebuild it again.
Right.
Which
that's smart.
We've learned that along the road because all management companies suck.
a lot of them, yeah.
Just to different degrees. You know, there's always, like, they always have a shelf life, maybe 4 or 5 years. I'm using one right now. I love them. But until I don't, right? Until, like, because
right.
they tend to get into, like, it's comfortable and they stop pushing. And, you know, as an entrepreneur, our job is to make sure that we're making money for our investors and the investment itself. We're business people. And so we have to push. And if they're not responsive to that, then sometimes you just got to make changes. But luckily, knock on wood, we've got a good group now, but still, do they do it all the ways that I want it to be done or do all the communication that I would really like? Not always, right? But it's still a good enough relationship that I don't want to go, the pain of moving is too much.
The pain of moving or the pain of doing it yourself, because that's that's the choice. Do I stay with third party where the communication is a little bit less and the decision making? You make the decisions, but the execution is less than desired. Or do you go out and build a big infrastructure and do it yourself?
That's where we're at right now, trying to figure out if that dial makes sense, because we have enough units under management to turn on self-managing, but it would be a whole nother business. And is that
yeah.
what I really want to do?
It is a whole nother business. I get some advice for you there. And this is what we did when we got to that level. We went out and we knew we were going to be at 10,000 at some particular point. At about 25, 3,000, we decided that we were going to have our own management company instead of hiring out. So we had two candidates. One guy was managing 7,500 units and another guy, and he was for 75,000 per year. And the other guy was managing 12,000 units and he wanted 150,000. And we went with the 150,000 guy for 12,000 because he was where we wanted to be, even though we knew we were a few years away. So, I mean, my advice to you is get somebody that's been in the business for a long period of time, been managing what you're managing and comes with all of the systems.
Yeah.
You know?
In other words,
you're not building anything.
Yeah, so that's exactly what we want to do. So I just want to hire the guy and be the chief of whatever, but not, we want to have that one person as the one that does all the hiring underneath them. So
hiring
yeah.
systems. Yeah.
Yes.
At all.
Good. Yeah, yeah, we're on the good. Same track, because I love my life now, and I don't want to complicate it, but you know, it's all about control eventually. Like, how do we control our product even more? And that's that's kind of neat to see that evolution, Dave, because as you know, you started, you're just trying to get your first deal.
Right. You know?
And then, oh, I'm just trying to replace my income. And then you're like, oh man, I replaced my income. Now I've got a real business model. And then when do you start making the changes? And now that's where we're starting to get to, is like, now we're looking at becoming a true operator in the marketplace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When I was in my early days, when I had all the three families, we started managing for other people, because we figured since we could, you know, we're doing ourselves, we might as well make some more money on the side with another business. That turned out to be a big mistake. That was a big pain in the butt, managing other people's properties. And then I remember when we had this decision, and my partner came to me and he says, you know, we should really do our own. I said, look, we'll do our own, but you're going to be the CEO. We're going to hire this guy. And then I'm going to be, you know, chairman of the board.
Chairman of the board. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Because I know management, you know, managing sucks.
Yeah, you can get in the weeds, and that's just not how we work, right?
Yeah, we're deal makers.
Yeah.
Go and do more deals. Hey, any pieces of advice that you want to share before we go into what I call lightning round? I know you're not familiar with this, but we're going to go into another phase of this interview.
Yeah, man, all I can say is just follow the system. I look back, and the one thing that I've done with all my other guys didn't is I've just stayed true to the system, right? Yep. I've added a little, you know, tweaks along the way, but like, I just follow, it's your basic system that you've taught. I just do it. That's all I've ever done. I make great broker relationships, and I meet people with money.
That's it. You know, this is what I tell people. You follow the system at the beginning until you get a few deals under your belt, and then you build that real estate gut, and then you can start tweaking the system to your needs. But until you do that, just follow it. Don't try to figure it. Don't try to think you're smarter than the system, because if you don't have the experience, you're not.
Yeah.
You know, and what might seem like conventional wisdom isn't in this particular business. So you just, the people that are the most successful follow it, and then they tweak it around, you know, when they're ready.
That's exactly what we've done. It's been a great model.
Yeah. All right. So we're going to play a lightning round. Okay. I'm going to ask you some quick questions. You're going to give me some quick answers.
Okay.
Okay. So first, texting or talking?
Texting.
Favorite day of the week?
Friday.
Favorite city in the U.S. besides the one you live in?
Kauai, but that's not a city, but that's where I'm going to go.
That's my favorite too. Honolulu Bay.
Yep.
Nickname your parents called you?
Corman.
Last song you downloaded?
Oh gosh. Something by probably Hall & Oates.
Wow. Was that years ago, or are you just going down?
No, I just thinking, I don't know. Cause I was looking and searching for some old stuff, and I just remember they came to mind. Hall & Oates.
All right. favorite holiday?
Christmas.
Speak every language or speak to animals?
Speak to animals.
Bitcoin, boom or bust?
Bitcoin, stupid.
Fill in the blank. Taylor Swift is?
A genius.
What superpower do you want most?
I want to be the invisible man.
All right. And the final question, is it wrong for a vegetarian to eat animal crackers?
Only if you eat them on Thursdays.
All right. This has been another edition of Deal Lab with Corey Peterson. I wish everybody a good week, and take care, everyone. Thanks, Corey. It's been great.
You've been listening to the Multifamily Deal Lab podcast, where the deals get done. If you'd like to learn more, visit davesfreebook.com. And don't forget to leave a 5-star rating and review, and hit that subscribe button so you don't miss an episode. Thanks for listening.